Side 6. The City and the Stars and the Sands of Mars by Arthur C. Clarke. Continuing with The City and the Stars on page 210. Yet he was very glad. Now, surely, the long ages of sterile isolation would be ending. The knowledge that he had succeeded in what had once been his main mission cleared away the last doubts from Alvin's mind. He had fulfilled his purpose here on Earth, more swiftly and more thoroughly than he had dared to hope. The way lay clear ahead for what might be his last, and would certainly be his greatest, adventure. "Will you come with me, Hilvar?" he said, all too conscious of what he was asking. Hilvar looked at him steadfastly. "There was no need to ask that, Alvin," he said. "I told Sir Annis and all my friends that I was leaving with you a good hour ago." They were very high when Alvin gave the robot its final instructions. The ship had come almost to rest, and the Earth was perhaps 1,000 miles below, nearly filling the sky. It looked very uninviting. Alvin wondered how many ships in the past had hovered here for a little while and then continued on their way. There was an appreciable pause, as if the robot was checking controls and circuits that had not been used for geological ages. Then came a very faint sound, the first that Alvin had ever heard from a machine. It was a tiny humming, which soared swiftly octave by octave until it was lost at the edge of hearing. There was no sense of change of motion, but suddenly he noticed that the stars were drifting across the screen. The Earth reappeared and rolled past, then appeared again in a slightly different position. The ship was hunting, swinging in space like a compass needle seeking the north. For minutes the skies turned and twisted around them, until at last the ship came to rest, a giant projectile aimed at the stars. Centered in the screen, the great ring of the 7 suns lay in its rainbow-hued beauty. A little of Earth was still visible as a dark crescent, edged with the golden crimson of the sunset. Something was happening now, Alvin knew, beyond all his experience. He waited, gripping his seat, while the seconds drifted by and the 7 suns glittered on the screen. There was no sound, only a sudden wrench that seemed to blur the vision. But Earth had vanished, as if a giant hand had whipped it away. They were alone in space, alone with the stars and a strangely shrunken sun. Earth was gone, as though it had never been. Again came that wrench, and with it now the faintest murmur of sound. As if for the first time the generators were exerting some appreciable fraction of their power. Yet for a moment, it seemed that nothing had happened. Then Alvin realized that the sun itself was gone, and that the stars were creeping slowly past the ship. He looked back for an instant and saw nothing. All the heavens behind had vanished utterly, obliterated by a hemisphere of night. Even as he watched, he could see the stars plunge into it, to disappear like sparks falling upon water. The ship was travelling far faster than light, and Alvin knew that the familiar space of Earth and Sun held him no more. When that sudden, vertiginous wrench came for the third time, his heart almost stopped beating. The strange blurring of vision was unmistakable now. For a moment his surroundings seemed distorted out of recognition. The meaning of that distortion came to him in a flash of insight he could not explain. It was real, and no delusion of his eyes. Somehow he was catching, as he passed through the thin film of the present, a glimpse of the changes that were occurring in the space around him. At the same instant, the murmur of the generators rose to a roar that shook the ship, a sound doubly impressive, for it was the first cry of protest that Alvin had ever heard from a machine. Then it was all over, and the sudden silence seemed to ring in his ears. The great generators had done their work. They would not be needed again until the end of the voyage. The stars ahead flared blue-white and vanished into the ultraviolet. Yet by some magic of science or nature, the 7 suns were still visible, though now their positions and colours were subtly changed. The ship was hurtling toward them along a tunnel of darkness, beyond the boundaries of space and time, at a velocity too enormous for the mind to contemplate. It was hard to believe that they had now been flung out of the solar system at a speed which, unless it were checked, would soon take them through the heart of the galaxy and into the greater emptiness beyond. neither Alvin nor Hilvar could conceive the real immensity of their journey. The great sagas of exploration had completely changed man's outlook toward the universe, and even now, millions of centuries later, the ancient traditions had not wholly died. There had once been a ship, legend whispered, that had circumnavigated the cosmos between the rising and the setting of the sun. The billions of miles between the stars meant nothing before such speeds. To Alvin, this voyage was very little greater, and perhaps less dangerous than his first journey to Lys. It was Hilvar who voiced both their thoughts as the seven suns slowly brightened ahead. "Alvin," he remarked, "that formation can't possibly be natural." The other nodded. "I've thought that for years, but it still seems fantastic." "The system may not have been built by man," agreed Hilvar, "but intelligence must have created it. Nature could never have formed that perfect circle of stars, all equally brilliant. And there's nothing else in the visible universe like the central sun. Why should such a thing have been made, then?" "Oh, I can think of many reasons. Perhaps it's a signal, so that any strange ship entering our universe will know where to look for life. Perhaps it marks the center of galactic administration. Or perhaps, and somehow I feel that this is the real explanation, it's simply the greatest of all works of art. But it's foolish to speculate now. In a few hours, we shall know the truth." "We shall know the truth, perhaps," thought Alvin. "But how much of it shall we ever know?" It seemed strange that now, while he was leaving Diaspora, and indeed Earth itself, at a speed beyond all comprehension, his mind should turn once more to the mystery of his origin. Yet perhaps it was not so surprising. He had learned many things since he had first arrived in Lys, but until now he had not had a single moment for quiet reflection. There was nothing he could do now but sit and wait. His immediate future was controlled by the wonderful machine, surely one of the supreme engineering achievements of all time, that was now carrying him into the heart of the universe. Now was the moment for thought and reflection, whether he wished it or not. But first he would tell Hilvar all that had happened to him since their hasty parting only 2 days before. Hilvar absorbed the tale without comment and without asking for any explanations. He seemed to understand at once everything that Alvin described, and showed no signs of surprise even when he heard of the meeting with the central computer and the operation it had performed upon the robot's mind. It was not that he was incapable of wonder, but that the history of the past was full of marvels that could match anything in Alvin's story.
"It's obvious," he said when Alvin had finished talking, "that the central computer must have received special instructions regarding you when it was built. By now you must have guessed why."
"I think so. Kedron gave me part of the answer when he explained how the men who designed Diaspora had taken steps to prevent it becoming decadent."
"Do you think you, and the other uniques before you, are part of the social mechanism which prevents complete stagnation? So that whereas the jesters are short-term correcting factors, you and your kind are long-term ones?"
Hilvar had expressed the idea better than Alvin could, yet this was not exactly what he had in mind. "I believe the truth is more complicated than that. It almost looks as if there was a conflict of opinion when the city was built, between those who wanted to shut it off completely from the outside world and those who wanted to maintain some contacts. The first faction won, but the others did not admit defeat. I think Jarl and Zay must have been one of their leaders, but he was not powerful enough to act openly. He did his best, by leaving the subway in existence, and by ensuring that at long intervals, someone would come out of the Hall of Creation who did not share the fears of all his fellow men. In fact, I wonder..." Alvin paused, and his eyes veiled with thought, so that for a moment he seemed oblivious of his surroundings.
"What are you thinking now?" asked Hilvar.
"It's just occurred to me. Perhaps I am Jarl and Zay. It's perfectly possible. He may have fed his personality into the memory banks, relying on it to break the mold of Diaspora before it was too firmly established. One day I must discover what happened to those earlier uniques. That may help fill in the gaps in the picture."
"And Jarl and Zay, or whoever it was, also instructed the central computer to give special assistance to the uniques whenever they were created, mused Hilvar, following this line of logic. That's right. The ironic thing is that I could have got all the information I needed direct from the central computer without any assistance from poor Kedron. It would have told me more than it ever told him. But there's no doubt that he saved me a good deal of time and taught me much that I could never have learned by myself. I think your theory covers all the known facts, said Hilvar cautiously. Unfortunately, it still leaves wide open the biggest problem of all. The original purpose of Diaspora. Why did your people try to pretend that the outer world didn't exist? That's a question I'd like to see answered. It's a question I intend to answer, replied Alvin. But I don't know when or how. So they argued and dreamed, while hour by hour the seven suns drifted apart until they had filled that strange tunnel of night in which the ship was riding. Then, one by one, the six outer stars vanished at the brink of darkness, and at last only the central sun was left. Though it could no longer be fully in their space, it still shone with the pearly light that marked it out from all other stars. Minute by minute, its brilliance increased, until presently it was no longer a point but a tiny disk. And now the disk was beginning to expand before them. There was the briefest of warnings. For a moment, a deep, bell-like note vibrated through the room. Alvin clenched the arms of his chair, though it was a futile enough gesture. Once again, the great generators exploded into life, and with an abruptness that was almost blinding, the stars reappeared. The ship had dropped back into space, back into the universe of suns and planets, the natural world where nothing could move more swiftly than light. They were already within the system of the seven suns, for the great ring of coloured globes now dominated the sky. And what a sky it was! All the stars they had known, all the familiar constellations, had gone. The Milky Way was no longer a faint band of mist far to one side of the heavens. They were now at the centre of creation, and its great circle divided the universe in twain. The ship was still moving very swiftly toward the central sun, and the six remaining stars of the system were coloured beacons ranged around the sky. Not far from the nearest of them were the tiny sparks of circling planets, worlds that must have been of enormous size to be visible over such a distance. The cause of the central sun's nacreous light was now clearly visible. The great star was shrouded in an envelope of gas which softened its radiation and gave it its characteristic colour. The surrounding nebula could only be seen indirectly, and it was twisted into strange shapes that eluded the eye. But it was there, and the longer one stared, the more extensive it seemed to be. "Well, Alvin," said Hilvar, "we have a good many worlds to take our choice from. Or do you hope to explore them all?"
"It's lucky that won't be necessary," admitted Alvin. "If we can make contact anywhere, we'll get the information we need. The logical thing would be to head for the largest planet of the central sun.
Unless it's too large. Some planets, I've heard, were so big that human life could not exist on them. Men would be crushed under their own weight. I doubt if that will be true here, since I'm sure this system is entirely artificial.
In any case, we'll be able to see from space whether there are any cities and buildings."
Hilvar pointed to the robot. "Our problem has been solved for us. Don't forget, our guide has been here before. He is taking us home. And I wonder what he thinks about it." That was something that Alvin had also wondered. But was it accurate? Did it make any sense at all to imagine that the robot felt anything resembling human emotions now that it was returning to the ancient home of the master after so many eons? In all his dealings with it, since the central computer had released the blocks that made it mute, the robot had never shown any sign of feelings or emotion. It had answered his questions and obeyed his commands, but its real personality had proved utterly inaccessible to him. That it had a personality, Alvin was sure, otherwise he would not have felt that obscure sense of guilt which afflicted him when he recalled the trick he had played upon it, and upon its now dormant companion. It still believed in everything that the master had taught it.
Though it had seen him fake his miracles and tell lies to his followers, these inconvenient facts did not affect its loyalty. It was able, as had many humans before it, to reconcile two conflicting sets of data. Now it was following its immemorial memories back to their origin. Almost lost in the glare of the central sun was a pale spark of light, with around it the fainter gleams of yet smaller worlds. Their enormous journey was coming to its end. In a little while, they would know if it had been in vain. Chapter 20. The planet they were approaching was now only a few million miles away, a beautiful sphere of multicolored light. There could be no darkness anywhere upon its surface, for as it turned beneath the central sun, the other stars would march one by one across its skies. Alvin now saw very clearly the meaning of the Master's dying words. It is lovely to watch the colored shadows on the planets of eternal light. Now they were so close that they could see continents and oceans and a faint haze of atmosphere. Yet there was something puzzling about its markings, and presently they realized that the divisions between land and water were curiously regular. This planet's continents were not as nature had left them. But how small a task the shaping of a world must have been to those who built its suns.
"Those aren't oceans at all," Hilvar exclaimed suddenly. "Look, you can see markings in them."
Not until the planet was nearer could Alvin see clearly what his friend meant. Then he noticed faint bands and lines along the continental borders, well inside what he had taken to be the limits of the sea. The sight filled him with a sudden doubt, for he knew too well the meaning of those lines. He had seen them once before in the desert beyond Diaspa, and they told him that his journey had been in vain. "This planet is as dry as earth," he said dully. "Its water is all gone. Those markings are the salt beds where the seas have evaporated."
"They would never have let that happen," replied Hilvar. "I think that, after all, we are too late."
His disappointment was so bitter that Alvin did not trust himself to speak again, but stared silently at the great world ahead. With impressive slowness, the planet turned beneath the ship, and its surface rose majestically to meet them. Now they could see buildings, minute white incrustations everywhere save on the ocean beds themselves. Once this world had been the center of the universe. Now it was still. The air was empty, and on the ground were none of the scurrying dots that spoke of life. Yet the ship was still sliding purposefully over the frozen sea of stone, a sea which here and there had gathered itself into great waves that challenged the sky. Presently the ship came to rest, as if the robot had at last traced its memories to their source. Below them was a column of snow-white stone springing from the center of an immense marble amphitheater. Alvin waited for a little while. Then, as the machine remained motionless, he directed it to land at the foot of the pillar. Even until now, Alvin had half hoped to find life on this planet. That hope vanished instantly as the airlock opened. Never before in his life, even in the desolation of Shalmarane, had he been in utter silence. On Earth there was always the murmur of voices, the stir of living creatures, or the sighing of the wind. Here were none of these, nor ever would be again. "Why did you bring us to this spot?" asked Alvin. He felt little interest in the answer, but the momentum of his quest still carried him on, even when he had lost all heart to pursue it further.
"The Master left from here," replied the robot.
"I thought that would be the explanation," said Hilvar. "Don't you see the irony of all this? He fled from this world in disgrace. Now look at the memorial they built for him."
The great column of stone was perhaps 100 times the height of a man, and was set in a circle of metal slightly raised above the level of the plain. It was featureless and bore no inscription. For how many thousands or millions of years, wondered Alvin, had the Master's disciples gathered here to do him honor? And had they ever known that he died in exile on distant earth? It made no difference now. The Master and his disciples alike were buried in oblivion.
Come outside, urged Hilvar, trying to jolt Alvin out of his mood of depression. We have travelled halfway across the universe to see this place. At least you can make the effort to step outdoors. Despite himself, Alvin smiled and followed Hilvar through the airlock. Once outside, his spirits began to revive a little. Even if this world was dead, it must contain much of interest, much that would help him to solve some of the mysteries of the past. The air was musty, but breathable. Despite the many suns in the sky, the temperature was low. Only the white disk of the central sun provided any real heat, and that seemed to have lost its strength in its passage through the nebulous haze around the star. The other suns gave their quota of colour, but no warmth. It took only a few minutes to make sure that the obelisk could tell them nothing. The stubborn material of which it was made showed definite signs of age. Its edges were rounded, and the metal on which it was standing had been worn away by the feet of generations of disciples and visitors. It was strange to think that they might be the last of many billions of human beings ever to stand upon this spot. Hilvar was about to suggest that they should return to the ship and fly across to the nearest of the surrounding buildings, when Alvin noticed a long, narrow crack in the marble floor of the amphitheatre. They walked along it for a considerable distance, the crack widening all the time, until presently it was too broad for a man's legs to straddle. A moment later, they stood beside its origin. The surface of the arena had been crushed and splintered into an enormous shallow depression, more than a mile long. No intelligence, no imagination was needed to picture its cause. Ages ago, though certainly long after this world had been deserted, an immense cylindrical shape had rested here, then lifted once more into space and left the planet to its memories. Who had they been? Where had they come from? Alvin could only stare and wonder. He would never know if he had missed these earlier visitors by 1,000 or 1,000,000 years. They walked in silence back to their own ship. How tiny that would have looked beside the monster which once had rested here, and flew slowly across the arena until they came to the most impressive of the buildings flanking it. As they landed in front of the ornate entrance, Hilvar pointed out something that Alvin had noticed at the same moment. These buildings don't look safe. See all that fallen stone over there? It's a miracle they're still standing. If there were any storms on this planet, they would have been flattened ages ago. I don't think it would be wise to go inside any of them. I'm not going to. I'll send the robot. It can travel far faster than we can, and it won't make any disturbance which might bring the roof crashing down on top of it. Hilvar approved of this precaution, but he also insisted on one which Alvin had overlooked. Before the robot left on its reconnaissance, Alvin made it pass on a set of instructions to the almost equally intelligent brain of the ship, so that whatever happened to their pilot, they could at least return safely to Earth. It took little time to convince both of them that this world had nothing to offer. Together they watched miles of empty, dust-carpeted corridors and passageways drift across the screen as the robot explored these empty labyrinths. All buildings designed by intelligent beings, whatever form their bodies may take, must comply with certain basic laws, and after a while, even the most alien forms of architecture or design fail to evoke surprise, and the mind becomes hypnotized by sheer repetition, incapable of absorbing any more impressions. These buildings, it seemed, had been purely residential, and the beings who had lived in them had been approximately human in size. They might well have been men. It was true that there were a surprising number of rooms and enclosures that could be entered only by flying creatures, but that did not mean that the builders of this city were winged. They could have used the personal anti-gravity devices that had once been in common use, but of which there was now no trace in Diaspora. Alvin, said Hilvar at last, we could spend 1,000,000 years exploring these buildings. It's obvious that they've not merely been abandoned. They were carefully stripped of everything valuable that they possessed. We are wasting our time. Then what do you suggest? Asked Alvin. We should look at 2 or 3 other areas of this planet and see if they are the same, as I expect they are. Then we should make an equally quick survey of the other planets, and only land if they seem fundamentally different, or we notice something unusual. That's all we can hope to do unless we are going to stay here for the rest of our lives. It was true enough. They were trying to contact intelligence, not to carry out archaeological research. The former task could be achieved in a few days, if it could be achieved at all. The latter would take centuries of labor by armies of men and robots. They left the planet 2 hours later, and were thankful enough to go. Even when it had been bustling with life, Alvin decided this world of endless buildings would have been very depressing. There were no signs of any parks, any open spaces, where there could have been vegetation. It had been an utterly sterile world. And it was hard to imagine the psychology of the beings who had lived here. If the next planet was identical with this, Alvin decided he would probably abandon the search there and then. It was not. Indeed, a greater contrast would have been impossible to imagine. This planet was nearer the sun, and even from space it looked hot. It was partly covered with low clouds, indicating that water was plentiful. But there were no signs of any oceans. Nor was there any sign of intelligence. They circled the planet twice without glimpsing a single artifact of any kind. The entire globe, from poles down to the equator, was clothed with a blanket of virulent green. "I think we should be very careful here," said Hilvar. "This world is alive, and I don't like the color of that vegetation. It would be best to stay in the ship and not to open the airlock at all."
"Not even to send out the robot?"
"No, not even that. You have forgotten what disease is, and though my people know how to deal with it, we are a long way from home and there may be dangers here which we cannot see. I think this is a world that has run amok. Once it may have been all one great garden or park, but when it was abandoned, nature took over again. It could never have been like this while the system was inhabited."
Alvin did not doubt that Hilvar was right. There was something evil, something hostile to all the order and regularity on which Lys and Diaspora were based, in the biological anarchy below. Here, a ceaseless battle had raged for 1 billion years. It would be well to be wary of the survivors.
They came cautiously down over a great level plain, so uniform that its flatness posed an immediate problem. The plain was bordered by higher ground, completely covered with trees whose height could only be guessed. They were so tightly packed and so enmeshed with undergrowth that their trunks were virtually buried. There were many winged creatures flying among their upper branches, though they moved so swiftly that it was impossible to tell whether they were birds or insects, or neither. Here and there a forest giant had managed to climb a few scores of feet above its battling neighbors, who had formed a brief alliance to tear it down and destroy the advantage it had won. Despite the fact that this was a silent war, fought too slowly for the eye to see, the impression of merciless, implacable conflict was overwhelming. The plain, by comparison, appeared placid and uneventful. It was flat, to within a few inches, right out to the horizon, and seemed to be covered with a thin, wiry grass. Though they descended to within 50 feet of it, there was no sign of any animal life, which Hilvar found somewhat surprising. Perhaps, he decided, it had been scared underground by their approach. They hovered just above the plain, while Alvin tried to convince Hilvar that it would be safe to open the airlock, and Hilvar patiently explained such conceptions as bacteria, fungi, viruses and microbes, ideas which Alvin found hard to visualize, and harder still to apply to himself. The argument had been in progress for some minutes before they noticed a peculiar fact. The vision screen, which a moment ago had been showing the forest ahead of them, had now become blank. "Did you turn that off?"
said Hilvar, his mind as usual just one jump ahead of Alvin's.
"No,"
replied Alvin, a cold shiver running down his spine as he thought of the only other explanation.
"Did you turn it off?" he asked the robot.
"No,"
came the reply, echoing his own. With a sigh of relief, Alvin dismissed the idea that the robot might have started to act on its own volition, that he might have a mechanical mutiny on his hands.
Then why is the screen blank? He asked.
The image receptors have been covered.
I don't understand, said Alvin, forgetting for a moment that the robot would only act on definite orders or questions. He recovered himself quickly and asked, What's covered the receptors?
I do not know.
The literal-mindedness of robots could sometimes be as exasperating as the discursiveness of humans. Before Alvin could continue the interrogation, Hilvar interrupted.
Tell it to lift the ship. Slowly,
he said, and there was a note of urgency in his voice. Alvin repeated the command. There was no sense of motion, there never was. Then, slowly, the image reformed on the vision screen, though for a moment it was blurred and distorted. But it showed enough to end the argument about landing. The level plain was level no longer. A great bulge had formed immediately below them, a bulge which was ripped open at the top where the ship had torn free. Huge pseudopods were waving sluggishly across the gap, as if trying to recapture the prey that had just escaped from their clutches. As he stared in horrified fascination, Alvin caught a glimpse of a pulsing scarlet orifice, fringed with whip-like tentacles which were beating in unison, driving anything that came into their reach down into that gaping maw. Foiled of its intended victim, the creature sank slowly into the ground. And it was then that Alvin realized that the plain below was merely the thin scum on the surface of a stagnant sea.
What was that thing? He gasped.
I'd have to go down and study it before I could tell you that, Hilvar replied matter-of-factly. It may have been some form of primitive animal, perhaps even a relative of our friend in Shalmarain. Certainly it was not intelligent, or it would have known better than to try to eat a spaceship.
Alvin felt shaken, though he knew that they had been in no possible danger. He wondered what else lived down there beneath that innocent sward, which seemed to positively invite him to come out and run upon its springy surface.
I could spend a lot of time here, said Hilvar,
obviously fascinated by what he had just seen.
Evolution must have produced some very interesting results under these conditions. Not only evolution, but devolution as well, as higher forms of life regressed when the planet was deserted. By now equilibrium must have been reached, and... You're not leaving already?
His voice sounded quite plaintive as the landscape receded below them.
I am, said Alvin. I've seen a world with no life and a world with too much, and I don't know which I dislike more.
5,000 feet above the plain, the planet gave them one final surprise. They encountered a flotilla of huge, flabby balloons drifting down the wind. From each semi-transparent envelope, clusters of tendrils dangled to form what was virtually an inverted forest. Some plants, it seemed, in the effort to escape from the ferocious conflict on the surface, had learned to conquer the air. By a miracle of adaptation, they had managed to prepare hydrogen and store it in bladders so that they could lift themselves into the comparative peace of the lower atmosphere. Yet it was not certain that even here they had found security. Their downward-hanging stems and leaves were infested with an entire fauna of spidery animals, which must spend their lives floating far above the surface of the globe, continuing the universal battle for existence on their lonely aerial islands. Presumably, they must from time to time have some contact with the ground. Alvin saw one of the great balloons suddenly collapse and fall out of the sky, its broken envelope acting as a crude parachute. He wondered if this was an accident, or part of the life cycle of these strange entities. Hilvar slept while they waited for the next planet to approach. For some reason which the robot could not explain to them, the ship travelled slowly, at least by comparison with its universe-spanning haste, now that it was within a solar system. It took almost 2 hours to reach the world that Alvin had chosen for his third stop, and he was a little surprised that any mere interplanetary journey should last so long. He woke Hilvar as they dropped down into the atmosphere. "What do you make of that?" he asked, pointing to the vision screen. Below them was a bleak landscape of blacks and greys, showing no sign of vegetation or any other direct evidence of life. that there was indirect evidence. The low hills and shallow valleys were dotted with perfectly formed hemispheres, some of them arranged in complex symmetrical patterns. They had learned caution on the last planet, and after carefully considering all the possibilities, remained poised high in the atmosphere while they sent the robot down to investigate. Through its eyes, they saw one of the hemispheres approach until the robot was floating only a few feet away from the completely smooth, featureless surface. There was no sign of any entrance, nor any hint of the purpose which the structure served. It was quite large, over 100 feet high. Some of the other hemispheres were larger still. If it was a building, there appeared to be no way in or out. After some hesitation, Alvin ordered the robot to move forward and touch the dome. To his utter astonishment, it refused to obey him. This indeed was mutiny, or so at first sight it seemed. "Why won't you do what I tell you?" asked Alvin, when he had recovered from his astonishment. "It is forbidden," came the reply.
"Forbidden by whom?"
"I do not know."
"Then how..."
"No, cancel that. Was the order built into you?"
"No."
That seemed to eliminate one possibility. The builders of these domes might well have been the race who made the robot, and might have included this taboo in the machine's original instructions.
"When did you receive the order?" asked Alvin.
"I received it when I landed."
Alvin turned to Hilvar, the light of a new hope burning in his eyes.
"There's intelligence here. Can you sense it?"
"No,"
Hilvar replied.
"This place seems as dead to me as the first world we visited. I'm going outside to join the robot. Whatever spoke to it may speak to me."
Hilvar did not argue the point, though he looked none too happy. They brought the ship to Earth 100 feet away from the dome, not far from the waiting robot, and opened the airlock. Alvin knew that the lock could not be opened unless the ship's brain had already satisfied itself that the atmosphere was breathable. For a moment, he thought it had made a mistake. The air was so thin and gave such little sustenance to his lungs. Then, by inhaling deeply, he found that he could grasp enough oxygen to survive, though he felt that a few minutes here would be all that he could endure. Panting hard, they walked up to the robot and to the curving wall of the enigmatic dome. They took one more step, then stopped in unison, as if hit by the same sudden blow. In their minds, like the tolling of a mighty gong, had boomed a single message. "Danger. Come no closer." That was all. It was a message not in words, but in pure thought. Alvin was certain that any creature, whatever its level of intelligence, would receive the same warning in the same utterly unmistakable fashion, deep within its mind. It was a warning, not a threat. Somehow they knew that it was not directed against them. It was for their own protection. "Here," it seemed to say, "is something intrinsically dangerous, and we, its makers, are anxious that no one shall be hurt through blundering ignorantly into it." Alvin and Hilvar stepped back several paces and looked at each other, each waiting for the other to say what was in his mind. Hilvar was the first to sum up the position.
"I was right, Alvin," he said. "There is no intelligence here. That warning is automatic, triggered by our presence when we get too close."
Alvin nodded in agreement. "I wonder what they were trying to protect," he said. "There could be buildings, anything under these domes."
"There's no way we can find out if all the domes warn us off. It's interesting, the difference between the three planets we've visited. They took everything away from the first. They abandoned the second without bothering about it. But they went to a lot of trouble here. Perhaps they expected to come back someday and wanted everything to be ready for them when they returned.
But they never did. And that was a long time ago.
They may have changed their minds."
It was curious, Alvin thought, how both he and Hilvar had unconsciously started using the word "they." Whoever or whatever they had been, their presence had been strong on that first planet,
and was even stronger here. This was a world that had been carefully wrapped up and put away until it might be needed again.
"Let's go back to the ship," panted Alvin. "I can't breathe properly here."
As soon as the airlock had closed behind them and they were at ease once more, they discussed their next move. To make a thorough investigation, they should sample a large number of domes, in the hope that they might find one that had no warning and which could be entered. If that failed... But Alvin would not face that possibility until he had to. He faced it less than an hour later, and in a far more dramatic form than he would have dreamed. They had sent the robot down to half a dozen domes, always with the same result. When they came across a scene that was badly out of place on this tidy, neatly packaged world. Below them was a broad valley, sparsely sprinkled with the tantalizing, impenetrable domes. At its center was the unmistakable scar of a great explosion. An explosion that had thrown debris for miles in all directions and burned a shallow crater in the ground. And beside the crater was the wreckage of a spaceship. Chapter 21. They landed close to the scene of this ancient tragedy and walked slowly, conserving their breath, toward the immense broken hull towering above them. Only a short section, either the prow or the stern, of the ship remained. Presumably the rest had been destroyed in the explosion. As they approached the wreck, a thought slowly dawned in Alvin's mind, becoming stronger and stronger until it attained the status of certainty. "Huvar," he said, finding it hard to talk and walk at the same time. "I believe this is the ship that landed on the first planet we visited." Huvar nodded, preferring not to waste air. The same idea had already occurred to him. It was a good object lesson, he thought, for incautious visitors. He hoped it would not be lost on Alvin. They reached the hull and stared up into the exposed interior of the ship. It was like looking into a huge building that had been roughly sliced in two. Floors and walls and ceilings, broken at the point of the explosion, gave a distorted chart of the ship's cross-section. What strange beings, wondered Alvin, still lay where they had died in the wreckage of their vessel.
"I don't understand this," said Huvar suddenly. "This portion of the ship is badly damaged, but it's still fairly intact. Where's the rest of it? Did it break in two out in space, and this part crash here?"
Not until they had sent the robot exploring again, and had themselves examined the area around the wreckage, did they learn the answer. There was no shadow of doubt. Any reservations they might have had were banished when Alvin found the line of low mounds, each 10 feet long, on the little hill beside the ship.
"So they landed here," mused Huvar, "and ignored the warning. They were inquisitive just as you are. They tried to open that dome."
He pointed to the other side of the crater, to the smooth, still unmarked shell within which the departed rulers of this world had sealed their treasures. But it was no longer a dome. It was now an almost complete sphere, for the ground in which it had been set had been blasted away.
"They wrecked their ship and many of them were killed. Yet despite that, they managed to make repairs and leave again, cutting off this section and stripping out everything of value. What a task that must have been."
Alvin scarcely heard him. He was looking at the curious marker that had first drawn him to this spot. The slim shaft, ringed by a horizontal circle a third of the way down from its tip. Alien and unfamiliar though it was, he could respond to the mute message it had carried down the ages. Underneath those stones, if he cared to disturb them, was the answer to one question at least. It could remain unanswered. Whatever these creatures might have been, they had earned their right to rest. Huvar scarcely heard the words Alvin whispered as they walked slowly back to the ship. "I hope they got home," he said.
"And where now?"
asked Huvar when they were once more out in space. Alvin stared thoughtfully at the screen before replying.
"Do you think I should go back?" he said.
"It would be the sensible thing to do. Our luck may not hold out much longer, and who knows what other surprises these planets may have waiting for us."
It was the voice of sanity and caution,
and Alvin was now prepared to give it greater heed than he would have done a few days before. But he had come a long way, and waited all his life for this moment. He would not turn back while there was still so much to see. "We'll stay in the ship from now on," he said, "and we won't touch surface anywhere. That should be safe enough, surely." Hilvar shrugged his shoulders, as if refusing to accept any responsibility for what might happen next. Now that Alvin was showing a certain amount of caution, he thought it unwise to admit that he was equally anxious to continue their exploring, though he had long ago abandoned all hope of meeting intelligent life upon any of these planets. A double world lay ahead of them, a great planet with a smaller satellite beside it. The primary might have been the twin of the second world they had visited. It was clothed in that same blanket of livid green. There would be no point in landing here. This was a story they already knew. Alvin brought the ship low over the surface of the satellite. He needed no warning from the complex mechanism which protected him to know that there was no atmosphere here. All shadows had a sharp, clean edge, and there were no gradations between night and day. It was the first world on which he had seen something approaching night, for only one of the more distant suns was above the horizon in the area where they made first contact. The landscape was bathed in a dull red light, as though it had been dipped in blood. For many miles they flew above mountains that were still as jagged and sharp as in the distant ages of their birth. This was a world that had never known change or decay, had never been scoured by winds and rains. No eternity circuits were needed here to preserve objects in their pristine freshness. But if there was no air, then there could have been no life. Or could there have been? "Of course," said Hilvar when Alvin put the question to him, "there's nothing biologically absurd in the idea. Life can't originate in airless space, but it can evolve forms that will survive in it. It must have happened millions of times whenever an inhabited planet lost its atmosphere. But would you expect intelligent life forms to exist in a vacuum? Wouldn't they have protected themselves against the loss of their air? Probably. If it occurred after they achieved enough intelligence to stop it happening. But if the atmosphere went while they were still in the primitive state, they would have to adapt or perish. After they had adapted, they might then develop a very high intelligence. In fact, they probably would. The incentive would be so great." The argument, decided Alvin, was a purely theoretical one, as far as this planet was concerned. Nowhere was there any sign that it had ever borne life, intelligent or otherwise. But in that case, what was the purpose of this world? The entire multiple system of the seven suns, he was now certain, was artificial, and this world must be part of its grand design. It could, conceivably, be intended purely for ornament, to provide a moon in the sky of its giant companion. Even in that case, however, it seemed likely that it would be put to some use. "Look," said Hilvar, pointing to the screen. "Over there, on the right." Alvin changed the ship's course, and the landscape tilted around them. The red-lit rocks blurred with the speed of their motion. Then the image stabilized, and sweeping below was the unmistakable evidence of life. Unmistakable, yet also baffling. It took the form of a wide-spaced row of slender columns, each 100 feet from its neighbor and twice as high. They stretched into the distance, dwindling in hypnotic perspective until the far horizon swallowed them up. Alvin swung the ship to the right and began to race along the line of columns, wondering as he did so what purpose they could ever have served. They were absolutely uniform, marching in an unbroken file over hills and down into valleys. There was no sign that they had ever supported anything. They were smooth and featureless, tapering very slightly toward the top. Quite abruptly, the line changed its course, turning sharply through a right angle. Alvin overshot by several miles before he reacted and was able to swing the ship around in the new direction. The columns continued with the same unbroken stride across the landscape, their spacing perfectly regular. then, 50 miles from the last change of course, they turned abruptly through another right angle. At this rate, thought Alvin, we will soon be back where we started. The endless sequence of columns had so mesmerized them that when it was broken, they were miles past the discontinuity before Hilvar cried out and made Alvin, who had noticed nothing, turn the ship back. They descended slowly, and as they circled above what Hilvar had found, a fantastic suspicion began to dawn in their minds, though at first neither dared mention it to the other. Two of the columns had been broken off near their bases, and lay stretched out upon the rocks where they had fallen. Nor was that all. The two columns adjoining the gap had been bent outward by some irresistible force. There was no escape from the awesome conclusion. Now Alvin knew what they had been flying over. It was something he had seen often enough in Lys, but until this moment, the shocking change of scale had prevented recognition. Hilvar, he said, still hardly daring to put his thoughts into words, do you know what this is?
It seems hard to believe, but we've been flying around the edge of a corral. This thing is a fence that hasn't been strong enough.
People who keep pets, said Alvin, with the nervous laugh men sometimes use to conceal their awe, should make sure they know how to keep them under control. Hilvar did not react to his forced levity. He was staring at the broken barricade, his brow furrowed with thought.
I don't understand it, he said at last. Where could it have got food on a planet like this? And why did it break out of its pen? I'd give a lot to know what kind of animal it was.
Perhaps it was left here and broke out because it was hungry, Alvin surmised. Or something may have made it annoyed.
Let's go lower, said Hilvar. I want to have a look at the ground.
They descended until the ship was almost touching the barren rock, and it was then that they noticed that the plain was pitted with innumerable small holes, no more than an inch or two wide. Outside the stockade, however, the ground was free from these mysterious pockmarks. They stopped abruptly at the line of the fence.
You are right, said Hilvar. It was hungry. But it wasn't an animal. It would be more accurate to call it a plant. It had exhausted the soil inside its pen and had to find fresh food elsewhere. It probably moved quite slowly. Perhaps it took years to break down those posts.
Alvin's imagination swiftly filled in the details he could never know with certainty. He did not doubt that Hilvar's analysis was basically correct, and that some botanical monster, perhaps moving too slowly for the eye to see, had fought a sluggish but relentless battle against the barriers that hemmed it in. It might still be alive, even after all these ages, roving at will over the face of this planet. To look for it, however, would be a hopeless task, since it would mean quartering the surface of an entire globe. They made a desultory search in the few square miles around the gap, and located one great circular patch of pockmarks, almost 500 feet across, where the creature had obviously stopped to feed, if one could apply that word to an organism that somehow drew its nourishment from solid rock. As they lifted once more into space, Alvin felt a strange weariness come over him. He had seen so much, yet learned so little. There were many wonders on all these planets, but what he sought had fled them long ago. It would be useless, he knew, to visit the other worlds of the Seven Suns. Even if there was still intelligence in the universe, where could he seek it now? He looked at the stars scattered like dust across the vision screen, and knew that what was left of time was not enough to explore them all. A feeling of loneliness and oppression such as he had never before experienced seemed to overwhelm him. He could understand now the fear of diaspora for the great spaces of the universe, the terror that had made his people gather in that little microcosm of their city. It was hard to believe that, after all, they had been right. He turned to Hilvar for support. But Hilvar was standing, fists tightly clenched, and with a glazed look in his eyes. His head was tilted on one side. He seemed to be listening, straining every sense into the emptiness around them. "What is it?" said Alvin urgently.
He had to repeat the question before Hilvar showed any sign of hearing it. He was still staring into nothingness when he finally replied.
"There's something coming," he said slowly. "Something that I don't understand."
It seemed to Alvin that the cabin had suddenly become very cold, and the racial nightmare of the invaders reared up to confront him in all its terror. With an effort of will that sapped his strength, he forced his mind away from panic.
"Is it friendly?"
he asked.
"Shall I run for Earth?"
Hilvar did not answer the first question, only the second. His voice was very faint, but showed no sign of alarm or fear. It held rather a vast astonishment and curiosity, as if he had encountered something so surprising that he could not be bothered to deal with Alvin's anxious query.
"You're too late," he said. "It's already here."
The galaxy had turned many times on its axis since consciousness first came to Vanimont. He could recall little of those first eons and the creatures who had tended him then. But he could remember still his desolation when they had gone and left him alone among the stars. Down the ages since, he had wandered from sun to sun, slowly evolving and increasing his powers. Once he had dreamed of finding again those who had attended his birth, and though the dream had faded now, it had never wholly died. On countless worlds, he had found the wreckage that life had left behind, but intelligence he had discovered only once, and from the black sun he had fled in terror. Yet the universe was very large, and the search had scarcely begun. Far away though it was in space and time, the great burst of power from the heart of the galaxy beckoned to Vanimont across the light years. It was utterly unlike the radiation of the stars, and it had appeared in his field of consciousness as suddenly as a meteor trail across a cloudless sky. He moved through space and time toward it, to the latest moment of its existence, sloughing from him in the way he knew the dead, unchanging pattern of the past. The long metal shape, with its infinite complexities of structure, he could not understand, for it was as strange to him as almost all the things of the physical world. Around it still clung the aura of power that had drawn him across the universe, but that was of no interest to him now. Carefully, with the delicate nervousness of a wild beast, half poised for flight, he reached out toward the two minds he had discovered, and then he knew that his long search was ended. Alvin grasped Hilvar by the shoulders and shook him violently, trying to drag him back to a greater awareness of reality.
"Tell me what's happening," he begged. "What do you want me to do?"
The remote, abstracted look slowly faded from Hilvar's eyes.
"I still don't understand," he said. "But there's no need to be frightened, I'm sure of that. Whatever it is, it won't harm us. It seems simply interested."
Alvin was about to reply when he was suddenly overwhelmed by a sensation unlike any he had ever known before.
A warm, tingling glow seemed to spread through his body.
It lasted only a few seconds, but when it was gone, he was no longer merely Alvin. Something was sharing his brain, overlapping it as one circle may partly cover another. He was conscious also of Hilvar's mind close at hand, equally entangled in whatever creature had descended upon them. The sensation was strange rather than unpleasant, and it gave Alvin his first glimpse of true telepathy, the power which in his people had so degenerated that it could now be used only to control machines. Alvin had rebelled at once when Serranus had tried to dominate his mind. But he did not struggle against this intrusion. It would have been useless, and he knew that this creature, whatever it might be, was not unfriendly. He let himself relax, accepting without resistance the fact that an infinitely greater intelligence than his own was exploring his mind. But in that belief, he was not wholly right. One of these minds, Vanimont saw at once, was more sympathetic and accessible than the other. He could tell that both were filled with wonder at his presence, and that surprised him greatly. It was hard to believe that they could have forgotten. Forgetfulness, like mortality, was beyond the comprehension of Vanimont. Communication was very difficult. Many of the thought images in their minds were so strange that he could hardly recognize them.
He was puzzled and a little frightened by the recurrent fear pattern of the invaders. It reminded him of his own emotions when the Black Sun first came into his field of knowledge. But they knew nothing of the Black Sun, and now their own questions were beginning to form in his mind. "What are you?" He gave the only reply he could. "I am Vanimont." There came a pause. How long the pattern of their thoughts took to form. And then the question was repeated. They had not understood. That was strange, for surely their kind had given him his name for it to be among the memories of his birth. Those memories were very few, and they began strangely at a single point in time, but they were crystal clear. Again their tiny thoughts struggled up into his consciousness. "Where are the people who built the Seven Suns? What happened to them?" He did not know. They could scarcely believe him, and their disappointment came sharp and clear across the abyss separating their minds from his. But they were patient, and he was glad to help them. For their quest was the same as his, and they gave him the first companionship he had ever known. As long as he lived, Alvin did not believe he would ever again undergo so strange an experience as this soundless conversation. It was hard to believe that he could be little more than a spectator, for he did not care to admit even to himself that Hilvar's mind was in some ways so much more capable than his own. He could only wait and wonder, half dazed by the torrent of thought just beyond the limits of his understanding. Presently, Hilvar, rather pale and strained, broke off the contact and turned to his friend. "Alvin," he said, his voice very tired. "There's something strange here. I don't understand it at all." The news did a little to restore Alvin's self-esteem, and his face must have shown his feelings, for Hilvar gave a sudden sympathetic smile. "I can't discover what this Vanimond is," he continued. "It's a creature of tremendous knowledge, but it seems to have very little intelligence. Of course," he added, "its mind might be of such a different order that we can't understand it. Yet somehow I don't believe that is the right explanation." "Well, what have you learned?" asked Alvin with some impatience. "Does it know anything about the Seven Suns?" Hilvar's mind still seemed very far away. "They were built by many races, including our own," he said absently. "It can give me facts like that, but it doesn't seem to understand their meaning. I believe it's conscious of the past, without being able to interpret it. Everything that's ever happened seems jumbled together in its mind." He paused thoughtfully for a moment, then his face lightened. "There's only one thing to do. Somehow or other, we must get Vanimond to Earth so that our philosophers can study him."
"Would that be safe?" asked Alvin.
"Yes," answered Hilvar, thinking how uncharacteristic his friend's remark was. "Vanimond is friendly. More than that, in fact, he seems almost affectionate." And quite suddenly, the thought that all the while had been hovering at the edge of Alvin's consciousness came clearly into view. He remembered Criff and all the small animals that were constantly escaping, to the annoyance and alarm of Hilvar's friends. And he recalled, how long ago that seemed, the zoological purpose behind their expedition to Shalmarain. Hilvar had found a new pet. Chapter 22. How completely unthinkable, Jezerak mused, this conference would have seemed only a few short days ago. The six visitors from Lys sat facing the council along a table placed across the open end of the horseshoe. It was ironic to remember that not long ago, Alvin had stood at the same spot and heard the council rule that Diaspora must be closed again from the world. Now the world had broken in upon it with a vengeance, and not only the world, but the universe. The council itself had already changed. No less than five of its members were missing. They had been unable to face the responsibilities and problems now confronting them, and had followed the path that Kedron had already taken. It was, thought Jezerak, proof that Diaspora had failed if so many of its citizens were unable to face their first real challenge in millions of years.
many thousands of them had already fled into the brief oblivion of the memory banks, hoping that when they awoke, the crisis would be past, and Diaspora would be its familiar self again. They would be disappointed. Jezerak had been co-opted to fill one of the vacant places on the council. Though he was under something of a cloud, owing to his position as Alvin's tutor, his presence was so obviously essential that no one had suggested excluding him. He sat at one end of the horseshoe-shaped table, a position which gave him several advantages. Not only could he study the profiles of his visitors, but he could also see the faces of his fellow councillors, and their expressions were sufficiently instructive. There was no doubt that Alvin had been right, and the council was slowly realizing the unpalatable truth. The delegates from Lys could think far more swiftly than the finest minds in Diaspora. Nor was that their only advantage, for they also showed an extraordinary degree of coordination, which Jezerak guessed must be due to their telepathic powers. He wondered if they were reading the councillor's thoughts, but decided that they would not have broken the solemn assurance without which this meeting would have been impossible. Jezerak did not think that much progress had been made. For that matter, he did not see how it could have been made. The council, which had barely accepted the existence of Lys, still seemed incapable of realizing what had happened. But it was clearly frightened, and so, he guessed, were the visitors, though they managed to conceal the fact better. Jezerak himself was not as terrified as he had expected. His fears were still there, but he had faced them at last. Something of Alvin's own recklessness, or was it courage, had begun to change his outlook and give him new horizons. He did not believe he would ever be able to set foot beyond the walls of Diaspora, but now he understood the impulse that had driven Alvin to do so. The president's question caught him unawares, but he recovered himself quickly. "I think," he said, "that it was sheer chance that this situation never arose before. We know that there were 14 earlier uniques, and there must have been some definite plan behind their creation. That plan, I believe, was to ensure that Lys and Diaspora would not remain apart forever. Alvin had seen to that, but he has also done something which I do not imagine was ever in the original scheme. Could the central computer confirm that?" The impersonal voice replied at once.
"The councillor knows that I cannot comment on the instructions given to me by my designers."
Jezerak accepted the mild reproof.
"Whatever the cause, we cannot dispute the facts. Alvin has gone out into space. When he returns, you may prevent him leaving again, though I doubt if you will succeed, for he may have learned a great deal by then. And if what you fear has happened, there is nothing any of us can do about it. Earth is utterly helpless, as she has been for millions of centuries."
Jezerak paused and glanced along the tables. His words had pleased no one, nor had he expected them to do so.
"Yet I don't see why we should be alarmed. Earth is in no greater danger now than she has always been. Why should two men in a single small ship bring the wrath of the invaders down upon us again? If we'll be honest with ourselves, we must admit that the invaders could have destroyed our world ages ago."
There was a disapproving silence. This was heresy. And once, Jezerak himself would have condemned it as such. The president interrupted, frowning heavily.
"Is there not a legend that the invaders spared Earth itself only on condition that man never went into space again? And have we not now broken those conditions?"
"A legend, yes," said Jezerak. "We accept many things without question, and this is one of them. However, there is no proof of it. I find it hard to believe that anything of such importance would not be recorded in the memories of the central computer, yet it knows nothing of this pact. I have asked it, though only through the information machines. The council may care to ask the question directly."
Jezerak saw no reason why he should risk a second admonishment by trespassing on forbidden territory, and waited for the president's reply. It never came. For in that moment the visitors from Lys suddenly started in their seats, while their faces froze in simultaneous expressions of incredulity and alarm. They seemed to be listening while some faraway voice poured its message into their ears. The counsellors waited, their own apprehension growing minute by minute, as the soundless conversation proceeded. Then the leader of the delegation shook himself free from his trance and turned apologetically to the president. "We have just had some very strange and disturbing news from Liss," he said.
"Has Alvin returned to Earth?" asked the president.
"No, not Alvin. Something else." As he brought his faithful ship down in the Glade of Airlie, Alvin wondered if ever in human history any ship had brought such a cargo to Earth. If indeed, Vanimond was located in the physical space of the machine. There had been no sign of him on the voyage. Hilvar believed, and his knowledge was more direct, that only Vanimond's sphere of attention could be said to have any position in space. Vanimond himself was not located anywhere. Perhaps not even any when. Serranus and five senators were waiting for them as they emerged from the ship. One of the senators Alvin had already met on his last visit. The other two from that previous meeting were, he gathered, now in diaspora. He wondered how the delegation was faring, and how the city had reacted to the presence of the first intruders from outside in so many millions of years.
"It seems, Alvin," said Serranus dryly after she had greeted her son, "that you have a genius for discovering remarkable entities. Still, I think it will be some time before you can surpass your present achievement."
For once, it was Alvin's turn to be surprised. "Then Vanimond's arrived?"
"Yes. Hours ago. Somehow he managed to trace the path your ship made on its outward journey. A staggering feat in itself, and one which raises interesting philosophical problems. There is some evidence that he reached Liss at the moment you discovered him, so that he is capable of infinite speeds. And that is not all. In the last few hours he has taught us more of history than we thought existed."
Alvin looked at her in amazement. Then he understood. It was not hard to imagine what the impact of Vanimond must have been upon his people, with their keen perceptions and their wonderfully interlocking minds. They had reacted with surprising speed, and he had a sudden incongruous picture of Vanimond, perhaps a little frightened, surrounded by the eager intellects of Liss.
"Have you discovered what he is?" Alvin asked. "Yes, that was simple. Though we still don't know his origin. He's a pure mentality, and his knowledge seems to be unlimited. But he's childish, and I mean that quite literally."
"Of course!" cried Hilvar. "I should have guessed."
Alvin looked puzzled, and Serranus took pity on him.
"I mean that although Vanimond has a colossal, perhaps an infinite mind, he's immature and undeveloped. His actual intelligence is less than that of a human being."
She smiled a little wryly.
"Though his thought processes are much faster, and he learns very quickly. He also has some powers we do not yet understand. The whole of the past seems open to his mind in a way that's difficult to describe. He may have used that ability to follow your path back to Earth."
Alvin stood in silence, for once somewhat overcome. He realized how right Hilvar had been to bring Vanimond to Liss, and he knew how lucky he had been ever to outwit Serranus. That was not something he would do twice in a lifetime.
"Do you mean," he asked, "that Vanimond has only just been born?" "By his standards, yes. His actual age is very great, though apparently less than man's. The extraordinary thing is that he insists that we created him, and there's no doubt that his origin is bound up with all the great mysteries of the past."
"What's happening to Vanimond now?" asked Hilvar in a slightly possessive voice.
"The historians of Gravan are questioning him. They are trying to map out the main outlines of the past, but the work will take years. Vanimond can describe the past in perfect detail, but as he doesn't understand what he sees, it's very difficult to work with him."
Alvin wondered how Serranus knew all this.
Then he realized that probably every waking mind in Lys was watching the progress of the great research. He felt a sense of pride in the knowledge that he had now made as great a mark on Lys as on Diaspora, yet with that pride was mingled frustration. Here was something that he could never fully share nor understand. The direct contact, even between human minds, was as great a mystery to him as music must be to a deaf man or colour to a blind one. Yet the people of Lys were now exchanging thoughts with this unimaginably alien being, whom he had led to Earth, but whom he could never detect with any sense that he possessed. There was no place for him here. When the inquiry was finished, he would be told the answers. He had opened the gates of infinity, and now felt awe, even fear, for all that he had done. For his own peace of mind, he must return to the tiny, familiar world of Diaspora, seeking its shelter while he came to grips with his dreams and his ambition. There was irony here. The one who had spurned the city to venture out among the stars was coming home as a frightened child runs back to its mother. Chapter 23. Diaspora was none too pleased to see Alvin again. The city was still in a ferment, like a giant beehive that had been violently stirred with a stick. It was still reluctant to face reality. But those who refused to admit the existence of Lys and the outside world no longer had a place to hide. The memory banks had ceased to accept them. Those who tried to cling to their dreams and to seek refuge in the future now walked in vain into the Hall of Creation. The dissolving, heatless flame refused to greet them. They no longer awoke, their minds washed clean, 100,000 years further down the river of time. No appeal to the central computer was of any avail, nor would it explain the reason for its actions. The intended refugees had to turn sadly back into the city to face the problems of their age. Alvin and Hilvar had landed at the periphery of the park, not far from Council Hall. Until the last moment, Alvin was not certain that he could bring the ship into the city through whatever screens fenced its sky from the outer world. The firmament of Diaspora, like all else about it, was artificial, or at least partly so. Night, with its starry reminder of all that man had lost, was never allowed to intrude upon the city. It was protected also from the storms that sometimes raged across the desert and filled the sky with moving walls of sand. The invisible guardians let Alvin pass, and as Diaspora lay spread out beneath him, he knew that he had come home. However much the universe and its mysteries might call him, this was where he was born and where he belonged. It would never satisfy him, yet always he would return. He had gone halfway across the galaxy to learn this simple truth. The crowds had gathered even before the ship landed, and Alvin wondered how his fellow citizens would receive him now that he had returned. He could read their faces easily enough as he watched them through the viewing screen before he opened the airlock. The dominant emotion seemed to be curiosity, in itself something new in Diaspora. Mingled with that was apprehension, while here and there were unmistakable signs of fear. No one, Alvin thought a little wistfully, seemed glad to see him back. The Council, on the other hand, positively welcomed him, though not out of pure friendship. Though he had caused this crisis, he alone could give the facts on which future policy must be based. He was listened to with deep attention as he described his flight to the Seven Suns and his meeting with Vanimond. Then he answered innumerable questions with a patience which probably surprised his interrogators. Uppermost in their minds, he quickly discovered, was the fear of the invaders, though they never mentioned the name and were clearly unhappy when he broached the subject directly. "If the invaders are still in the universe," Alvin told the Council, "then surely I should have met them at its very centre. But there is no intelligent life among the Seven Suns. We had already guessed that before Vanimond confirmed it. I believe that the invaders departed ages ago. Certainly Vanimond, who appears to be at least as old as Diaspora, knows nothing of them." "I have a suggestion," said one of the councillors suddenly.
Vanamond may be a descendant of the invaders in some way beyond our present understanding. He has forgotten his origin, but that does not mean that one day he may not be dangerous again.
Hilvar, who was present merely as a spectator, did not wait for permission to speak. It was the first time that Alvin had ever seen him angry.
Vanamond has looked into my mind, he said, and I have glimpsed something of his. My people have already learned much about him, though they have not yet discovered what he is. But one thing is certain, he is friendly and was glad to find us. We have nothing to fear from him.
There was a brief silence after this outburst, and Hilvar relaxed with a somewhat embarrassed expression. It was noticeable that the tension in the council chamber lessened from then on, as if a cloud had lifted from the spirits of those present. Certainly the president made no attempt, as he was supposed to do, to censure Hilvar for his interruption. It was clear to Alvin, as he listened to the debate, that three schools of thought were represented on the council. The conservatives, who were in a minority, still hoped that the clock could be turned back, and that the old order could somehow be restored. Against all reason, they clung to the hope that Diaspora and Lys could be persuaded to forget each other again. The progressives were an equally small minority. The fact that there were any on the council at all pleased and surprised Alvin. They did not exactly welcome this invasion of the outer world, but they were determined to make the best of it. Some of them went so far as to suggest that there might be a way of breaking through the psychological barriers which for so long had sealed Diaspora even more effectively than the physical ones. Most of the council, accurately reflecting the mood of the city, had adopted an attitude of watchful caution, while they waited for the pattern of the future to emerge. They realized that they could make no general plans, nor try to carry out any definite policy, until the storm had passed. Jezerak joined Alvin and Hilvar when the session was over. He seemed to have changed since they had last met, and last parted in the Tower of Loran, with the desert spread out beneath them. The change was not one that Alvin had expected, though it was one that he was to encounter more and more often in the days to come. Jezerak seemed younger, as if the fires of life had found fresh fuel and were burning more brightly in his veins. Despite his age, he was one of those who could accept the challenge that Alvin had thrown to Diaspora.
"I have some news for you, Alvin," he said. "I think you know Senator Garain."
Alvin was puzzled for a moment, then he remembered.
"Of course. He was one of the first men I met in this. Isn't he a member of their delegation?"
"Yes. We have grown to know each other quite well.
He is a brilliant man, and understands more about the human mind than I would have believed possible. Though he tells me that by the standards of Lys, he is only a beginner. While he is here, he is starting a project which will be very close to your heart. He is hoping to analyze the compulsion which keeps us in the city, and he believes that once he has discovered how it was imposed, he will be able to remove it. About 20 of us are already cooperating with him."
"And you are one of them?"
"Yes," replied Jezerak, showing the nearest approach to bashfulness that Alvin had ever seen or ever would see. "It is not easy, and certainly not pleasant, but it is stimulating."
"How does Garain work?"
"He is operating through the sagas. He has had a whole series of them constructed, and studies our reactions when we are experiencing them. I never thought at my age that I should go back to my childhood recreations again."
"What are the sagas?" asked Hilvar.
"Imaginary dream worlds," exclaimed Alvin. "At least most of them are imaginary, though some are probably based on historical facts. There are millions of them recorded in the memory cells of the city. You can take your choice of any kind of adventure or experience you wish, and it will seem utterly real to you while the impulses are being fed into your mind." He turned to Jezerak.
"What kind of sagas does Garain take you into?"
"Most of them are concerned, as you might expect, with leaving Diaspora. Some have taken us back to our very earliest lives, to as near to the founding of the city as we can get. Garain believes that the closer he can get to the origin of this compulsion, the more easily he will be able to undermine it."
Alvin felt very encouraged by this news. his work would be merely half accomplished if he had opened the gates of Diaspora, only to find that no one would pass through them.
"Do you really want to be able to leave Diaspora?"
asked Hilvar shrewdly.
"No," replied Jezrak without hesitation. "I am terrified of the idea, but I realize that we were completely wrong in thinking that Diaspora was all the world that mattered, and logic tells me that something has to be done to rectify the mistake. Emotionally, I am still quite incapable of leaving the city. Perhaps I always shall be."